There's something I have to ask you.
May I ask you a question?
That is a question. Would you like to ask me another one?
Austin Kleon is a writer, artist, and speaker obsessed with the art of communicating with pictures and words on the web. Before he became a full-time artist, Austin was a librarian, a web designer, an advertising copywriter. He grew up in the cornfields of Ohio, but now he lives in Austin, Texas, with his wife, Megan, and their dog, Milo. Austin, thanks so much for being with us today. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Sure. This is really cool. Just to let everyone know, I first heard about you, and I mentioned this when I met you finally in person about a month ago. I heard about you through another artist, John T. Unger. He had a podcast. I heard about him from Chris Guillebeau's World Domination Summit, which Kim and I attended last year. And I actually remember exactly, I was painting Lucy's bedroom because we were transitioning. We had the new one on the way, and we were transitioning her to the big girl room. And so I had the plastic down, I was painting everything, and I was listening to this podcast with you and John. So it's funny how you remember these things. But I remember it because there were so many things that you said that just resonated with me at the time, because I think the last couple years or so I've been going through a thing where I've kind of been bringing my art back up to the forefront, something that I started out doing, kind of transitioned away a little bit. And so just some of the stuff you talked about of creativity and art really resonated, including your blog post, Steal Like an Artist, which was then turned into a book. But before that, we need to give you a chance to talk about probably the thing you became known for first, I suppose, your newspaper blackout poems, which
are awesome.
I saw those at the panel. That's really cool. Yeah. And so explain to people as best as you can without visually. We'll have links to it in the actual post.
Yeah.
But what are the newspaper blackout poems? Start with that and how that started.
Well, okay. So when I was right out of college, I call myself a writer who draws. And the reason I do that is because I'm actually trained as a writer. Like, I went to school to learn how to write, but drawing was always something I did from the time I'm very little. I mean, you know, I think all children, you know, Picasso's got this great quote. He says, "All children are artists. The problem is just how to remain one when you grow up."
Yeah, I love that one.
Yeah, and I'm one of those people that just didn't stop drawing. But when I was in college, I very much felt that art was the less serious thing. I thought that literature, you know, was the more serious thing to do, and that art was something that would never make me any money and would never, you know, go anywhere. So, when I was in school, I studied writing very intensely, and right towards the end of my undergraduate work, I started bringing drawing back into my process. And I actually, my undergraduate thesis was really strange. It was all about using visual thinking techniques for writing. So it was all about, like, you know, storyboarding short stories, drawing maps, you know, all this kind of wacky stuff, which I really should have just done a graphic novel. But so basically what happened was, when I got right out of undergrad, I just hit the pretty, you know, the standard case of writer's block. You know, I was without a audience, I was without an outlet, and I just really didn't know what I was supposed to be doing. So basically what happened is, my we've always subscribed to the newspaper. And you know the thing with newspapers, they just stack up in the recycle bin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you throw them out every week, but you feel like, you know, maybe I should be doing something with these. So I actually started making collages out of pictures from the newspaper. And I started, like, doing little collages in my journal and stuff like that. But finally I realized that, like, I was neglecting the majority of what was in the newspaper, and that was words. So I thought, well, maybe I could make a collage out of words. So what I actually did was, I just picked up a marker that I draw with, and I started circling words. And then I started, like, kind of connecting them into these little phrases or little, you know, mini narratives or little one-liners. And then what I decided to do was just black out the rest of the article instead of actually cutting out the words. And so it kind of looks like if the CIA did haiku. It looks like one of those government redacted documents. And And the Newspaper Blackout, you know, title just kind of came to me, and I called them Newspaper Blackout Poems. And just like everyone else, you know, I started posting them to my blog, and, you know, just slowly over time, they just kind of took on a life of their own, and I kept doing them, and that's where we are now.
They're very cool. They're very striking. I know in the book you talk about how that you know, you've done some research since then and have seen that it's kind of there's a long line of similar sorts of things, but there's no doubt you've kind of taken your own spin and put that into it. So it's really cool. And then of course this all led in one way or another to your book, which I mentioned was originally a blog post, I think. Steal Like an Artist. So give us a little overview about that. What's the premise? Why did you write it? Who's it for?
So one of the things that happened when I was doing Newspaper Blackout was I would get all these comments and emails from people telling me just how unoriginal I really was. So they pointed out all these artists who had basically been doing Newspaper Blackouts for like 250 years. And so I found out that like there's this long history and lineage of people like William Burroughs or people like the artist Tom Phillips. And even going back to the 1700s, I found a guy who used to he would read columns across. He would read across the columns instead of reading top to bottom. So he would come up with all these funny combinations. Huh. And so what I found is just that, you know, I think that would have been really kind of discouraging to a lot of young artists. But I had already kind of been of the opinion that like art is not about originality. It's about art is really about taking what's come before you and doing what Ezra Pound said. He said, make it new. Mm-hmm. So I really – what I did instead of stopping the poems is I just researched these people who had come before me more deeply and intensely than I think a lot of people had, and just kind of like built them into my own family tree and stole literally everything I could from them to kind of put it into my own work and to kind of push my work forward. So what happened was I started collecting – I got very interested in this idea of borrowing and influence. And so I actually started researching and collecting quotes of famous artists who had actually admitted that what they do is theft. Like what they – like literally how they get their ideas is they kind of steal them. They steal them from the greats. And they kind of put their, you know, they combine them with other ideas and then they turn them into their own thing and put them out in the world. And actually what they come up with is new. It is something, you know, pushing the art forward. So how Steal Like an Artist actually came to be, it started out as a series of blog posts just of quotes of artists talking about borrowing and creative theft. But then when I was asked to give a commencement or actually it was a convocation speech at this community college in upstate New York, I was really nervous because I was really nervous about talking to college kids about what they should do with their lives, you know, because I'm not that – I mean, I'm 20 – I think I was 28 at the time or 27 or 28. I'm 28 now. I'm about to turn 29, and, you know, I thought I'm not even that much older than these kids. I don't know what to tell them. And my wife said, you know, well, the best talk I ever heard was a woman came to my high school, and she said she literally just had a list of things she wished she would have heard when she was in high school. Hmm. And I thought, that's great. I'm going to do that. Hmm. And so I just kind of came up with this list. I mean, I had been writing – I mean, part of my deal with making my art is I'm also a blogger, and I'm constantly thinking about the process of art and collecting kind of inspirational quotes. I'm just a meticulous – or not a meticulous, I'm a voracious quote collector, and I'm a kind of voracious reader too. So I just kind of like wrote this list of what I thought, you know, just a list of 10, you know, of what I thought people would, what I would have liked to hear when I was that age. And we went up to upstate New York and I gave the talk and it went over really well. But I'm one of those people that's kind of a digital native, so I something doesn't actually happen unless it's on the internet. So when I came home, I was like, you know what? I got these cool slides. I've got this talk that's already written out. Like, why don't I just turn it into a big long blog post? And I just posted online and went to bed. And it literally went viral overnight. I mean, it more than anything I've ever done. I mean, it crashed my site, and it, like, you know, I was just bombed with emails, and it was this big mess, you know. But immediately I realized, like, well, this is the next book, you know. It was very obvious. I mean, people were saying that to me, and I was already kind of thinking it. So, sure enough, you know, I contacted a guy I'd already been talking to about an agent I'd already been in contact with. I had tons of emails from editors, so we just put together, you know, spent like 2 or 3 months putting together a book proposal, and then we, you know, had it at auction, and then Workman Publishing bought it. And then took about it was a really rushed book. I hate to say rushed, but I wrote the book and illustrated it in 2 or 3 months. So it was really a fast process, because one of the cool things about Workman where they were like, we want to get this out for graduation season next year.
Nice.
Which is now. So this was all a year ago. And so that's pretty much the story of the book. But what's happened is, since it's been out, is Workman Publishing is just one of those incredible publishers that still believes in books. They believe in the quality of books, and what they do really well is they put out really nicely designed, substantial books for not a lot of money. Mm-hmm. So Steel is like, I think it's like 11, 12 bucks, and it's printed on like super nice paper. Mm-hmm. It's got French flaps, you know, it's just like this really nice little package, but it's really cheap. So Workman is very into the old school model of publishing, which is they still send authors on book tours. So I've been doing a 20-city tour behind Steel. And so, you know, one of the things I tell people about books is, like, hopefully the book is not the end of anything. Like, a book is just a souvenir of your ideas. It's not really – if a book does really well, the beginning of the book's life is really the publication. You know, and then hopefully the book has this life of its own. And the problem as an author is to just figure out how you help it continue to live and grow and turn into its own thing and reach the people that it should be reaching. You know, so yeah. Sorry, that was a long.
No, it's good.
That was a long story.
Well, it's obviously been very successful, bestseller, yeah. New York Times bestseller, right? I think that's what I saw.
Yeah. It's awesome. It's been on the bestseller list for like 7 or 8 weeks now, which is
awesome.
Crazy. I mean, the book hasn't been out for more than 3 months, so.
Awesome. And now you mentioned they wanted to get out for graduation season. Who do you see this as for? Because I'm assuming it's not just for artists, right?
Yeah, I really, you know, our push with this book was to make it very inclusive. I have I'm one of those people that has a very broad definition of creativity. Like, you know, people come up to me all the time and they're like, oh, I just wish I was creative, you know? I'm just not creative. And I, you know, and I look at them like, have you ever cooked a meal? And they're like, oh, well, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, so do you like to cook? And they're like, oh, yeah, I love to cook. And I said, so when you're making a recipe, do you ever add anything? You know, do you ever add any extra seasonings or try something different? You know, and they're like, oh, yeah, well, I did this, you know, pizza the other day, and I added this thing and cooked it a little bit longer. And I said, that's creativity. Like, you are putting together ingredients that are out in the world. And you're putting them through a process and you're making something that wasn't there before. Like, that's, and when I explain it to people in that way, they really, I realize just how mythologized creativity has really become in our culture. Just that creativity is this magical thing that happens that only, you know, magicians can perform. You know, it's like, yeah. It's just not, the way I, whenever I go into like a creative agency, like an advertising agency, I always tell them, like, I do not believe in creative as a noun. Like, I used to have creative on my business card when I was a copywriter, and I used to scratch it out and put writer underneath, because I don't think creativity is a noun. I think creativity is a verb. Mm-hmm. I think creativity is something that we do, and it's something we can get better at. John Cleese, the Monty Python comedian and performer, he said, you know, creativity is a way of operating. Hmm. And I love that, because what that means is that, you know, you can't necessarily teach someone to be creative, but what you can teach them is how they can set up their life in a way that they can access their own creativity better and keep hold of it. So what Steal Like an Artist is really like, what it really is, it's a way of setting up your life in, it's kind of a manifesto for setting up your life in a way that you can just access your own creativity better.
That's huge. Yeah. When I was teaching kindergarten, I taught kindergarten for 5 years, and as you can imagine, the kids were all very naturally creative, which
exactly
is, you know, what we talk about with our escape adulthood premise, that we need to get back to these childlike traits. So what do you think, I mean, why do you think people get to a point where they can't think of themselves as creative anymore? What do you think happens there?
Well, I think a couple of things happen. I mean, you know, my favorite thinker on this topic is a woman named Linda Barry. She's a cartoonist, and she's written I really recommend that everyone who's interested in being creative read her book, What It Is, because that book really blew open. Knowing Linda and her reading her book really blew open creativity for me, just help me see. And one of the things Linda talks about is, like, if you hand a 5-year-old a piece of paper and a crayon, they will draw something for you. Mm-hmm. If you hand a 13-year-old a crayon and a piece of paper, they're going to look at you like you're an alien. You know, I mean, a clam up, a lot of them will,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
So I think a couple of things happen. I think Jonah Lehrer in his book Imagine writes about it a little bit more, and he talks more about how the brain becomes, like, more aware of itself. You know, the brain is still developing, and the self-conscious kind of part of the brain kind of becomes more adaptable, or it becomes more evolved, and people become, you know, more self-conscious. I actually subscribe more to a social theory of it, which is, you know, when you hit about middle school or late elementary school, you start getting graded on your creativity. You know, I mean, like, you start, like, an art class. It's like some people get first place ribbons and some don't get anything. And I think a lot of kids are told, like, well, you know, you start getting, everything starts getting stratified, right? It's like, oh, well, here's the college prep kids. Here are the kids that are going to go to vocational school. You know, here are the, you know, you start getting labeled very early on. And I think the reason that, you know, people think that, I've just been around that my whole life. I mean, I just remember being a kid, and I remember being in school and people saying, oh, you're just such a good drawer. Like, I just, man, you just got it, you know? And I'm just like, and I used to remember, like, I got it because that's all I do. Like, if you, you know, I mean, because people, you know, I mean, I grew up in this really small town, and I remember thinking, I remember how the tables have, you know, like, I remember when I was younger, you know, my cousin and I learned to draw by copying Garfield cartoons on our grandma's kitchen floor. I mean, that's basically, right, like, how we taught, you know, like, copying Looney Tunes and everything. And I just remember very clearly when he stopped drawing and started playing, he stopped drawing and started playing sports. Hmm. Now, when we were younger, he was the better artist. You know, I really think that he was the one who was better. I was the one trying to copy him. But he went and started playing sports. And the thing about being in a small town is the reward system for being very good at sports is way higher than some weirdo who sits around and draws all day. So he, you know, he really became, you know, people gave him lots of attention, and he was a really great athlete. And, you know, I'm over in the corner still drawing, and I'm a terrible athlete. I mean, the thing I loved about sports was sitting on the bench and, like, spitting and swearing and hanging out with the guys. Yeah, so I always like yeah, I like the social aspect of sports. You know, my dad one time went to a track meet of mine, and I was a long distance person. And he watched one of our, I think it was like a 1200 or something. And at the end, he came up to me and he said, "Hey, Austin, I noticed you're really not giving it your all there. Like, I mean, you were literally dead middle in the pack." And I said, "Oh yeah, Dad, I'm just here for the girls." I mean, you know, I said, you know, track is the great sport because the girls and the guys get to travel together and hang out and stuff. You know?
Yeah. And he said, like smart. Yeah.
Yeah, and I remember he said to me, "Well, do you mind if I don't come to any more of these?"
Aww. I
said, "No, I don't care. Yeah. I don't care." You know, but the point I was going to make is like you become good at what you spend the most time doing. I mean, of course, we all have gifts, and we all have, you know, I think you're predisposed with certain talents, but it's all a matter of what you do with them, you know. And if you, you know, a very concrete example is, so one of my favorite things about BookTor is signing people's books. And when I sign books, you know, my book is not – people think that my book, the script, because all the headers are handwritten and the cover's hand-drawn and stuff, people think that's a font. Like I made a font and typed it out, but it's actually my handwriting. So when I sign a book, people kind of – their eyes light up. And they're like, "Oh, my God, you really write like that." And it kind of takes me back, and I'm like, "Well, yeah, I write like this. This is my book." You know? and they say, "Oh, God, I just wish I had good handwriting. I just have terrible handwriting." I say, "Well, you know how I got my handwriting?" And they're like, "Well, how?" I'm like, "I used to get liner notes from, like, CDs, and, like, I remember the first person was Phil Collins." Phil Collins CDs all in records, it's all his handwriting. Like, he used to write his name, and, like, he even has his face on the cover. I mean, I think he's kind of a narcissist. But all of the liner notes were written in his hand, and I remember looking at that and being like, "That is cool handwriting. I want that handwriting." And I used to literally copy Phil Collins' handwriting my notebook. And then I remember when I found John Lennon's handwriting. I used to be a musician when I was younger. I mean, that's what I wanted to do, so... like, I would copy John Lennon's handwriting, and then I found Jimi Hendrix's handwriting, and so I, like, copy his handwriting. I've done that my whole life. I mean, I see handwriting that I love, and I spend a good amount of time copying it, and then what happens is, you know, I've copied, you know, probably a few dozen people's handwriting over time, and what happens is that act of copying becomes my own thing. You know, now I have this handwriting that... You know, and I explain that to people, and I'm like, if you like someone's handwriting, start copying it. You know, and you'll find
practice what you preach, man.
Yeah, awesome. You know, but I'm
you should write a
clear
book on that.
Yeah, you know, but it's really I'm just always trying to, like, encourage people. Like, look, yes, like, do I have, you know, am I inclined to have good handwriting? Like, yeah, I mean, my hands operate. I mean, I've always used my hands. I mean, I was a piano player when I was younger. I've been drawing my whole life. Like, my hands are tools, and they're very good at emulating and picking up things. But that's only because I put the time in, you know? Mm-hmm. But I do not consider myself a very original person. I mean, I just really don't. I mean, I really consider myself as someone who's just got taste, you know? I'm from a very particular place, and I have certain tastes, and I just soak up everything, and then I just spit it out in this different, you know, way. And I just feel like that's how the thing is like, even the geniuses that I've studied, they all put it that way. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not. So I guess, like, my MO is just like demystifying creativity. I just want people to realize that on a broader scale, you know, you can become the person you want to become. And the way that you do it is you find people who are doing the sorts of things that you want to do, and you just emulate them. And then what happens is eventually you should want to become someone that's no one else is. And in the process of emulating your heroes, you find out what they didn't make and what they missed and what the new context is in your life, and then you find that spot. That's how you do it.
Yeah. So you're sort of like the magician that other magicians don't like because you reveal all the tricks of how they do things. So it's like you got this thing where, okay, creativity is not this mythological thing. It can be this is how it works. And
it's very empowering.
It's fun.
Yeah.
But I say that jokingly because you're totally right on with how
it
works.
It's true. I mean, I even say that in the book. I'm like, artists are not magicians. There's no penalty for revealing your secrets. Although there is, in a sense, that, you know, you think about the artists you meet and how, I want to make this family friendly. You know, it's like, it's just, you know, ego and mystique and, you know, everyone talks about authenticity. You know, that's like the big word now. It's like, authenticity. You know, that's the big term. And the thing that I've always thought is that actually authenticity is just when what people think about you is in sync with what they witness you doing. Hmm. And I know that's kind of a harsh, kind of unromantic way of thinking about it, but like, take someone like Louis C.K., the comedian. Like, everyone I know thinks that Louis C.K. is the most authentic person that out there right now. But I don't know anything about Louis C.K. other than what I see in his work and what I've read about him in interviews. I mean, I have a feeling that he's a really great person, that he's someone who works on his craft really hard and, like, thinks very deeply about stuff and does it, but I couldn't tell you. I don't know who he is. All I know is that what he presents to us what he presents to me syncs up with my value system, so I like him, and then what he does is in sync with what he presents to me. You know, like putting his special out for $5. Mm-hmm. You know, like stuff like that. So I think that, like, you know, there are more important things in art than authenticity. Like, people think that, like, you know, you have to be authentic, you have to be true to yourself, you know. And I'm for me, it's always been about, I want to become the best version of myself. You know, I want to become someone who I want to be. You know, there's a certain amount of self-invention that comes with everyone's life, you know. And I think in that sense, we're all creative because we are all bridging the gap between what we think we are and what we want to be. And making that leap requires an enormous amount of creativity. You know, taking the things that we have and turning them into something that's not there.
Yeah, that's well said. I like the idea of, you know, you kind of mentioned that you don't think creativity can be taught per se, but like this book is sort of a guide to help people set up their lives in a way to kind of unleash that creativity that's already there. And there's a couple themes that I pulled out I thought would be kind of interesting to get your take on. One of them especially that kind of appealed to me was the idea of don't throw any of yourself away. And I look back at where Kim and I are now, where I am now, and what I get to do with combining my art and drawing and speaking and these different talents that don't seem to fit. I have a job now that certainly wouldn't have been when I was in high school, would have showed up on any sort of exam where you take this, okay, you'd be good as an engineer, you'd be good as this. Like, but it's kind of, it resonated with me, this idea of all the different things about yourself that may seem unrelated, maybe are not so. Can you speak about a little bit about that concept of the don't throw any of yourself away?
That was, yes, that was a concept that I completely stole from this playwright in Austin, Texas, a guy named Stephen Tomlinson. He's just this really interesting guy. He studied at seminary, but he also is a theater guy, and he gave a TED talk, a TEDx talk in Austin that just blew my mind, where he talked about this concept. For me personally, I like I said before, I was someone who actively discarded parts of my personality when I was younger because I thought one thing was worth more attention, you know? But when I was growing up, I mean, the pieces were already in place. I was very interested in computers. We got the dial-up internet when I was 14, and it came with
the dial-up sound.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it came with a little bit of web space, and I remember thinking back then, I'm stuck in this small town. Everybody knows who my parents are. Everyone knows my business. They all know I'm this geek that, you know, they grew up with. But this web space, like, I could literally become whoever I wanted to be on here. Like, I could put all my, you know, I could put my journal up here. I could put my drawings. I could put my band's music on here, even though that would have taken up, like, all the web space. but, like, I remember thinking that very specifically. But then, you know, I was also a musician. I was also an artist. I mean, I loved to write. But I just, you know, Stephen had the same experience that I did in college. He went to one of his mentors and his professors, and he said, I love the seminary, but I really love playwriting, and I just really love business. So which one should I choose? You know? And the player and his mentor just looked at him and said, that's the dumbest question I've ever heard. He said, and then he prescribed to him. He said, do all of those things. Give them all a certain amount of time each week. Spend time with them, even if it's 2 or 3 hours, and they'll start to talk to each other. And pretty soon, you know, you might not have a career comes out of that, but you'll have a life. And that just, the way Stephen put that, I just thought, God, that is exactly it. Because I just have this feeling that when you have a passion and you cut it out of your life, it's like phantom limb pain. Because, like, for instance, it was music for me. I spent when I was in college, I just didn't play music. I kind of cut it out of my life. And slowly over time, I just really felt that phantom limb pain. And, you know, about a year ago, about a year and a half ago, I started playing in a band here in Austin, just a garage band. We were just like, look, we're never going to tour. We're never going to do anything. You know, we're just going to, like, get together on Sunday and make a lot of noise and drink beer and awesome. Just do this thing, right?
Yeah.
And there was something. It was my therapy. I mean, it was my church and my therapy. I mean, every Sunday we would get together and practice. And I cannot tell you how I felt this just relief, you know, just like, oh, this thing is back. Like, and I felt myself getting better and just like, and then like when we were playing music, I would get all these ideas from my writing or my art, you know, and this kind of magical thing happened. I just really started feeling whole again. And, so I don't think it's any more. I think what we're dealing with right now is we're dealing with a world in which, you know, it's not enough anymore to just become a doctor or become a lawyer. Like, you have to be a doctor who's really into sports, or, you know, you have to be a lawyer who's really into art, or, you know, I mean, like, what we're finding in this world is so connected now, and everyone's career, no one's career is a sure bet. Like, everything is changing all the time. Mm-hmm. Is that really what you need is a unique point of view and a perspective. And that only comes from unique combinations of what you're interested in. You know, Loretta Lynn, she said, you either have to be first, great, or different. And so for me, it's always been more easier. Different is always the easier one. Because, like, first is tough. Because being first is not always the best thing.
Right.
Like, there are a lot of companies that they are the first people to do something, and then another company comes along and uses the idea and really makes it work. Great is really hard. Staying on top is just like super, super hard. But different just requires a few more ingredients, just adding a few more things to the pot, you know? And, for me, I'm not real, like I said before, like, sports is not my thing, but my friend Tim has a sports metaphor, a baseball metaphor. And he says, look, if you're just a good hitter in baseball, like, you've got to be a really, really good hitter. Like, you got to be Babe Ruth, you know. But he said, if you can hit and field, all of a sudden there's a place for you. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be about 50%. You could be you can be half a hitter and half a fielder and make things work, you know? Mm-hmm. But then if you're a fielder, a hitter, and a runner, then all of a sudden you can be thirds, you know? Mm-hmm. So like there's a well of, so for me personally, I'm not the best writer in the world at all. I'm actually a fairly mediocre writer. I'm not a great artist. I'm actually a pretty mediocre artist. I am definitely not a great web designer. I'm kind of a mediocre web designer. But when it comes to writers who draw and make stuff on the web, I would put myself up there pretty high, mm-hmm. you know, because of that unique combination. So, you know, and then when you start thinking about your autobiographical details where you're like, you know, dudes from a small town in Ohio who are, has a family and lives in Austin, Texas, and does these things, like, I'm pretty much the best at that, you know? And I think that also speaks, I think that also speaks to, you know, I don't know, it was some sports guy who said, like, I want to say Bo Jackson, but I don't think it was Bo Jackson. That's just the name that's coming. He said, you know, you don't want to be the best at what you do. You want to be the only person who does what you do. That's awesome. And that's combinatorial. That's what we're talking about creativity is like. Creativity, originality is about is not about, you know, coming up with stuff out of thin air. It's all about the combination, you know, it's like, what do you bring? What are you yourself bringing to what's happened before? And how do you put your own spin on it? You know,
so. Absolutely. Now, talking about all that, it reminds me of another section of your book when you're talking about energy and taking care of yourself and to do this, to, you know, be able to spend time on different parts of your interests and, you know, develop different hobbies and that sort of thing takes a lot of energy. So it's not just something that obviously happens without that. Yeah. And so you talk about the importance of taking care of yourself. Do you want to talk to that a little bit? Because that was a section that, like, I loved hearing, because as someone who's also working and raising a family and doing all this with our business, I tend to, you know, kind of feel a social pressure to burn the midnight oil or be one of those crazy people that gets up at 4 a.m. and works for 3 hours before everybody gets up. And I just can't do it. I just find myself saying, I have to conserve this energy.
Sleep is good.
Yeah. You know, rest, sleep, exercise, all that's really important. So what's your thoughts on that?
I think a couple of things. One, I think when you think of creative people and how they've been portrayed, and when you think about the great artists and writers and stuff, they've just been, I mean, for one thing, a lot of them are substance abuse users. I mean, like, you know, you think about, even someone like Don Draper. I think Don Draper is an interesting example because he's like the creative person on TV now. Like, he is the character that is supposed to be this kind of artistic creative genius that we see, and you know, he's an alcoholic, he's a womanizer, I mean, you know, he's like all these things that we think creatives are supposed to be. I mean, when I was a kid, when I was like 13 or 14, I thought that I'm trying to keep it family friendly again, I had a Kerouac boner, basically. I actually stole that term from George Saunders. I saw the writer George Saunders talk one time. He said he had a Kerouac boner when he was younger. What he meant by that was he just thought, like, I have to be on Benzedrine. I have to be, like, up all night, like, typing on this big scroll, and I have to go out and drink with my friends and, like, you know, have sex with as many women as I can, you know. But what's really interesting about, yes, Kerouac did all that stuff, but he also spent a ridiculous amount of time writing. And he was also kind of the sad guy who, when he blew all his money, like, he would go back to his mom's house and kind of hang out for a while. Wow. You know, so, I mean, there's all this stuff that you don't see. You'd never see Don Draper write 50 headlines and scratch them all out. You know, I mean, you're always like, he's never like, you always see like the end of the big creative push through, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think more than anything, it's just, we get this idea that being an artist or being a creative person, and again, this is the problem with using creative as a noun, means that we have to act a certain way, that it's a persona, you know? that it's a social position that you take that you have to like present to other people, when really it's all about the work. It's just all about what you do and sit down and actually make, you know. And I think the bottom line is that if you think about all the people who have had long, you know, barring Keith Richards, you know, it's
Johnny
like,
Depp's dad.
If you think, exactly. If you think about the people who have actually been able to have a long, successful career, they've always found a way to get clean, to channel their energy into something productive. Because I think when you're younger, you know, you have that Neil Young lyric in your head: "Better to burn out than to fade away." Mm-hmm. But you know, when you look at like, there's this thing called the 27 Club. Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, Brian Jones of the Rolling Stones. All these people died when they were 27. Hmm. And when I hit 27, I thought, geez. You know, I was like, first of all, I was glad I was still alive. Second, I just thought, oh my God, this is not a sprint, this is a marathon. Like, I was suddenly thinking, like, God, I want to do this until I'm, like, 80. You know, I want to be Maurice Sendak. You know, I want to be in my mid-80s and have a new book coming out. And, you know, I want to live long. I want to see my, you know, I was a joke, like, better to burn out than to fade away. No, actually, better to burn slow and see your grandkids. You know, I mean, that's where I want to be. But anyway, that's kind of a rant. But I think what it is it's just, like, people should not feel bad that they're not at all the right parties, that they're not out doing the glamorous like lifestyle. You know, you just have to think about the work you're doing, and you just have to identify like what's really important to you. And then you just have to carve out time for it, because I really think that time is just the magical. I think all people need time, space, and materials to get their work done. Like, if you have the time and the space, but you don't have the right materials, you're kind of screwed. If you have the materials and the space, but you don't have the time, then nothing's getting done. And if you have the materials and the time, but you don't have the space, that's hard too. Mm-hmm. But I think out of all those things, I really think that time is the magic, is the really important one, because you have just got to carve out time for what you want to be doing. And, you know, I always tell people, it's like, look, if you write a page a day, it just doesn't seem like anything, and you think you're wasting your time. But if you do that routinely for 365 days a year, you've got enough for a novel. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just the slow accumulation of work over time. So I just think that everyone can carve an hour out, basically, mm-hmm. you know, of their day. John Cleese, you know, he says like an hour and a half is pretty much like 45 minutes isn't enough, because once you hit about 45 minutes, you're really cooking. Mm-hmm. But he says like about after an hour and a half, you need a break anyway. So I really think if you can take 90 minutes, you know, the running time of like a romantic comedy, basically,
yeah.
you know, it's like if you can take 90 minutes out of your day, like you can do something that you want to do. Like, you can make something work. Like, I wrote my first book on my lunch break and on my commute to and from work on the bus. And that combined was about 90 minutes. And it worked, you know. I mean, it helped that I was making blackouts and I didn't need, you know. But I just think that a routine is way more important than having these huge blocks of time. But I just think that it's all about time management. And one of the things I tell young people who are like working at agencies and stuff who are creative in their day jobs is I say, you know, train yourself. I know we all work better at different times of the day, but train yourself to be a morning person, because if you get up in the morning and you work, then you go to work, they can't take it away from you. Mm. Like, it's already been done. And when I say that, I know some employers cringe when I say that, but but when I talk to employers, I say, look, if you have a young person who wants to be creative and they've already done their work at home, they are so much more pleasant and adjusted, mm-hmm. knowing that they've gotten that true passion work out of the way, that you'll get just as much out of them.
Yeah.
because they won't be resenting you that they're being taken away from this thing that they really want to do.
Yeah.
You know, because to run a creative agency or some sort of job where you want your people to be creative and to think that that's the only thing in their life is just – you just can't – that's just not – it's just not realistic.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm always encouraging people, you know, both employees and employers to kind of embrace that, you know. But
yeah, very cool. Nice.
Well, we want to thank you. Get to the end here. We've already gone longer than we'd hoped you would
not that we hoped.
Yes, that sounded bad. It was like I didn't want to hold you for so long because I know how busy you are. But we
Part of the problem of working from home now is that I'm very lonely. It's funny. Like I don't talk to people a lot. Like my wife goes to school, and I don't, you know, so I'm obviously very extroverted. So it's fun for me to talk to people.
Well, we're happy to hear.
And it's a way of procrastinating.
So we have a couple of, like, I suppose we call this our lightning round of, like, just sort of quick questions, quick answers, kind of some fun stuff. So first one, when you were little, you sort of touched on this in bits, I guess, but when you were little, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I wanted to be either Indiana Jones or Han Solo. I probably just wanted to be Harrison Ford.
Okay.
Indiana Jones, I thought, was so cool because he was an academic, he was an intellectual, but he was also an adventurer, and he was great with the ladies. So I wanted to be Indiana Jones.
Perfect combo.
Awesome. All right, what was your favorite toy when you were a kid?
Favorite toy as a kid. My mom would know. I had a teddy bear that was like my... I'm an only child, so I probably talk to my teddy bear a lot. A fuzzy the bear. So I'd say my teddy bear probably.
Okay.
Interesting. What is one event in your childhood that has had the greatest effect on what you do today? Is it the drawing the Garfield comics, or is there something else?
She was a guidance counselor, and before that she was a home ec teacher. And she actually became a high school principal later on. But my mom was very much into child development. And so my mom would sit me down and she would say, okay, you got a half hour. I got to make dinner. Here's some Play-Doh or here are some art supplies or something. Make me something. And so I'd have a half hour to make something for mom or whatever. And then she'd look at it and she'd say, this is wonderful. And she'd put it up on the fridge.
Aww,
and
that's cool.
So... me, when I talk to people, when I did Newspaper Blackout, I would actually not give a talk. I would actually just talk really quickly about the book and give everyone newspapers and markers and say, make me something. Because basically what happens in our adult lives is no one sits us down, gives us the materials, the time, the space, and says, make me something.
Hmm. Nice.
That's awesome. So this next question might actually tie into that too, but what lesson from mom do you still live by? So is there a special lesson from your mom that kind of connects in your day to day?
Oh God. Yeah. Oh God. That's easy. It's right in the book. Garbage in, garbage out.
Okay.
She used to say that to me, and she would use it as like an excuse for me not to be able to watch a certain TV show. But she would say that to me, and I hated it because I wanted the garbage, you know, I wanted the, but,
does.
Yeah. And now what that really translates into that I tell people now is you are a mashup of what you let into your life. And so you're only as good as your influences and the people you surround yourself with.
That's
I love that line. Yeah. You're a mashup of what you allow into your life. That's great. What's the dumbest thing you used to believe?
Oh God. Probably that. Oh my God. Jeez. Probably the dumbest thing I used to. Probably that you had to be from like New York City or California to be an artist. I mean, I really thought that. I just did not believe that someone from my small town could become someone. I didn't have any models when I was younger. I mean, I didn't know any writers. I didn't know any artists. I didn't know any musicians other than my friends. I just literally had no way of I just did not think that I could ever do those things successfully, you know, be able to make a living from them or whatever. So that's when I started discarding them, and I thought, oh, I'll just be a college professor instead. Like, that's a lot easier, ha ha. But, you know, I think that was my, when I was younger, I really thought that, like, artists were just these kind of ordained people, you know, they were just like ordained by the gods with their gifts, and they sprang out of nowhere, you know. But then I remember my girlfriend's dad in high school would tell me these stories about meeting Bob Dylan before he put his first album out. Mm-hmm. And Bob Dylan would lie to them and tell them where he was from. He'd say, like, oh, I'm from Albuquerque or whatever. And I remember thinking when I was that age, like, wow, Bob Dylan, he just, like, he's from Minnesota. He just, like, completely made up his persona and just, like, became Bob Dylan. You know, he's Bob Zimmerman, you know? So I just, like, I think that whole idea that, like, that artists are ordained instead of created, like, I guess that was, I don't know. That's what I thought anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's probably a pretty common thing, whether you want to be an artist or anything successful, you probably think, whether it's where you're from or what your gender is or what your race is, sure, or whatever, you're like, how could I possibly do that, you know?
I also thought that I was very taken with the Apple. You remember those Apple ads where they said, you know, the only one, they use the Kerouac, but the only one for me are the crazy ones.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, the misfits, the blah, blah, blah. Well, you know, the older I get, it's like, yeah, I like the misfits. I also like the people that are, like, go to bed on time and put their work, you know, it's kind of working. There's something about being easy to work with, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay, finally, now this might be weird to ask when you're in the middle of promoting Steal Like an Artist, but what's next? What's on the horizon? And not that it has to be this, like, race to do what's next, but what do you got on the horizon?
I think we're going to do a notebook for Steel. I think we're going to do like a little logbook that people, a lot of people have wanted to do the exercises that are in the book, but they've wanted like a kind of formal page that they could interact with. So I think we're going to put out like a workbook for Steel, the Steel logbook. That's definitely coming up. Book number 3 is just still in its like really nascent phases. I have a title in my head, but it's just not ready to be talked about. I have a book I really want to do about marriage and creativity. Mm-hmm. I think that someone needs to write a book, and I think it could be me, about looking at marriage as a creative collaboration and what, and you know, because I have this idea that when you have a partnership, doesn't matter whether you're gay, straight, or you know, whatever. I think when you have a partnership or even a business partnership or something like that, you're creating this third thing, you know? It's no longer about the two, like, people. It's about this third thing that you've created. Mm-hmm. And so I think in a lot of artistic collaborations, the same thing happens. It's no longer about these two collaborators or three collaborators. It's about, you know, it's not, like, about the bass player or about the singer. It's about the band. You know, the really great bands were able to, like, make something. You know, the Beatles, you take all of them as themselves, and they're all very interesting, but there was something about that magical combination of the Beatles, mm-hmm, that made it work. And so I just think that you can look at artistic collaboration as a lens through which to look at marriage and creative partnerships. But that's not as honestly, that when you talk to publishers, that'd be a great Kickstarter project. I could probably do it tomorrow on Kickstarter, but it's a little bit less commercial than some of the other things I'm working on. And that's just part of the, you know, that is part of the gig when you are making a living from work, you know, you have to go with what is, you know, going to put food on the table. Yeah. But I've got so much. I mean, really what I want to do is I just want a few weeks to not be on the road, to not hear the sound of my own voice. You know, I just want that time off. And of course, my wife is 21 weeks pregnant today. Aww. So the huge creative collaboration.
Yes.
That third thing.
That third thing is our kiddo that's coming to her. I feel like I'm too young to go into it, but I feel like I'm going into my John Lennon, Sean phase, you know, like staying home. kind of. But yeah, I'm not rich enough or successful enough to do that yet, though. So it'll be a real balance figuring out how to keep this career going and also be a good dad. So yeah, that's what I'm going to work.
That's tricky. I will say that when Kim and I we were, you know, speak about this adultitis thing, when people found out that we were pregnant with our first, then people would say, we'd get two types of people. One would say, oh my gosh, you got to talk about adultitis now. You have no idea. Kids are the cause of adultitis. And it started to freak me out. And then a little bit, then other people would say, you guys are going to love it so much. Kids are the cure to adultitis. So you hear that enough and you realize kids have nothing to do with it. It's about your mentality and the attitude that you take into it. So
you'll be fine.
Well, I just take such inspiration from people who make it work. Like, I really, you know, you want to talk about modeling. I mean, like, I've looked at the way that, like, one of my favorite cartoonists, like James Kochalka, has been able to integrate his work into his family life and how he is able to stay in contact with that kind of childlike wonder and, you know, creation that comes from, you know, that kind of, that you have to hold on to, you know? So I'm fully expecting my kid to teach me more than I teach him. Yeah. You know, I'm hoping anyway. But, you know, my favorite, so I'm just really looking forward to it.
You guys will have a good time. You guys will love it. But we want to thank you so much for spending the time. The hour just kind of flew by here, and it was awesome chatting with you.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was really fun.
Cool. Well, hopefully we'll catch up again sometime down the line. But for now, enjoy the rest of your tour. Congrats on the success of your book. Congrats on the new little one. And keep making some good stuff out there.
Thank you. Thanks to both of you.
Good talking with you, Austin. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.